We're looking at ethical issues around vaccine development on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists around the globe are racing toward a coronavirus vaccine, but there's growing concern that wealthy nations will be first in line, securing vast quantities of doses at the expense of poorer countries. This is what's known as vaccine nationalism, and we'll flesh that out, learn more about it. How should governments decide who should get the coronavirus vaccine first? Should the U.S. ensure all citizens are vaccinated before sharing resources with other countries? And what role should the World Health Organization, the WHO, have in a global strategy to control the virus? We're at 800-642-1234. Thomas Boyke is director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. He wrote the book called Plagues and the Paradox of Progress, Why the World is Getting Healthier in Worrisome Ways, and it came out in 2018. Thomas, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So as you look from your perspective through global health, what is worrisome to you as the pandemic spreads and you see how countries react and adjust?
So I have several worries. Obviously, a once-in-a-century pandemic itself is a cause for great concern. But I'll focus on three areas. The first is I am concerned, obviously, what's happening domestically here in the United States. I'm concerned heading into the winter season that our burden is so high. People were very much hoping that we would be able to drive down the virus to relatively low levels over the course of the summer so that we could give a bit of headroom for the increase that will happen as people move back indoors. And we also start to see your regular flu season happen in combination with coronavirus. So that's a concern. I'm concerned with the shift that's happening in South Asia, India in particular, and sub-Saharan Africa. India is now overtaken the U.S. in terms of numbers of new cases on average per week, and it's increasing rapidly. We're not seeing the multilateral attention you would see ordinarily to an international crisis, in part because wealthy countries are struggling with it on their own. The third area I'm concerned with is we're probably about 6 to 10 weeks away from getting results from phase three clinical trials on vaccines, and we don't seem any closer to arriving at an arrangement on who gets them first and how they are shared and whether they will be distributed according to public health needs.
Well, let's stop on that number three point and who gets the share of these doses. How does that work out when you look at history and in finding the doses for a virus and figuring out who gets what among countries? How does that work?
So it hasn't worked well in the past, unfortunately. I wish I could say otherwise, but in the past, when confronted by an urgent health crisis and limited medical supplies globally to address it, wealthy nations have tended to hoard those supplies. So in the 2009 pandemic of H1N1 influenza, a vaccine was actually developed in 7 months. It was modified vaccine that had existed before. But wealthy nations had bought up virtually all the supplies. It was only after the World Health Organization appealed and the United States, Canada, and seven other nations agreed to donate 10% of their vaccines to low and middle income countries. But they only agreed to do that months after it became clear that the virus was nowhere near as deadly as was expected, and after it was clear that they had more than enough supplies to meet domestic demand. So that's a bad precedent. In the course of this pandemic already, we've already seen more than 70 countries plus the European Union seize local supplies of personal protective equipment like masks, also testing kits, ventilators, and other crucial medical supplies. Over 70 countries seized those supplies for their own and didn't allow them to leave the country. Given that precedent, It's going to be an uphill battle to see a different result on vaccines. But because of the important role that vaccines play, it's critical that we do see a different result on vaccines, because otherwise the outcome could be quite grim.
Well, why is it that if you worry about your own home country first, you secure resources, and mind you, you've already put billions of dollars, maybe a lot more, into trying to get a vaccine, you have a lot of, may I say it, skin in the game here. Shouldn't you get the most share of the outcome?
So nobody would expect a country like the U.S. or others that may have access to vaccines early to forego vaccinating critically at-risk populations. So that's health workers, using vaccines to protect the vulnerable and elderly, whether that's giving to them directly or giving in them those vaccines to the people that are most likely to spread it to this vulnerable population, and using vaccines to vaccinate against, to try to break transmission chains of the virus spreading. Here's what people will hold against wealthy nations, including the United States, is will we insist on vaccinating everyone before sharing? So even low-risk members of the population, will we seek to vaccinate everyone? Because if that's the case, vaccine manufacturing capacity is scarce. We will use up all the supplies of vaccines, and other countries will have to wait months. That means their health workers, their critical vulnerable populations, will go without. And the challenge you have there is you will see health systems, as we've already seen in this pandemic, come near collapsing, bad economic consequences, and the pandemic will continue. And because the early vaccines won't be that protective, that puts us at risk as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Thomas Boyke. He's founder and managing editor of Think Global Health. We're talking about the ethics of COVID-19 vaccine development and deployment around the world and how countries will cooperate. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. When there is a vaccine, how should it roll out? How do you think countries should be able to negotiate doses? Call in. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring in Jeff now, joining us from Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. This is obviously a good topic, a relevant topic everywhere in the world, but it was announced in the news this morning that Russia has developed a vaccine. And my question is, have you heard of that? And is it possible this virus has regional components? In other words, maybe the vaccine works in Russia, but it might not work in, France or Canada.
Jeff, thank you. Thomas, what is your reaction to the news out of Russia this morning?
So it's actually not a surprise. Russia had announced a few weeks ago. It's a great question. So first of all, thank you for it, Jeff. But it's not a surprise. Russia had announced a few weeks ago that they were developing a vaccine and they were expecting to release it this week. Russia, the challenge is less whether this vaccine works regionally and more about whether it works at all. They've developed this vaccine in 2 months. They have done it by testing quote-unquote volunteers, including soldiers. They have done it without publishing the clinical trial data or doing any of the protections you would ordinarily see in a clinical trial. So we don't know a lot about this vaccine. We do know it didn't follow any of the procedures that you would ordinarily do to develop a vaccine. The risk there, of course, is vaccines are not like other medicines. You give them to healthy people, by and large, often children. And there are risks with vaccines. So I would be very cautious for Russian citizens to take this vaccine, but certainly any other nation. So there's not a lot about this vaccine that suggests that anyone should use it.
Is vaccine nationalism more of the norm approach for how countries react in a situation like this?
It is, unfortunately, the norm approach. In the past, countries really have tried to hoard. In this case, what's different about this pandemic is that it has been so severe and it is distributed worldwide. So one of the challenges you see that's drawn out by the good question with a vaccine like the Russia vaccine is ordinarily most countries wouldn't use a vaccine like this. In the past, when China developed its own Ebola vaccine, also through some less credible means, other countries didn't use it. It was used in China and that's it. The challenge you have in this case is if countries do not share vaccines and they do insist on vaccinating everyone, even low-risk populations, that will leave other countries with nothing.
And we have to pause there with global health expert Thomas Boyke from the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll pick this up in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the ethics around vaccine development and how to allocate a COVID-19 vaccine when the time comes. It is an hour-long conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Health economists say if countries around the world cooperate on this, it could stop the virus spread. But wealthy countries have put a lot of money into a treatment, and that could lead to feelings of entitlement. The World Health Organization is warning against what it calls vaccine nationalism, that richer countries would hoard treatments. How would you divide up vaccines in an equitable way? Should people be compelled to take a vaccine for the good of public health, or do you think people should be allowed to forgo getting vaccinated? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Thomas Boyke from the Council on Foreign Relations as our guide. Thomas, as we are talking there about Russia developing a vaccine or stating it has developed a vaccine, you know, this gets eyeballs all across the world because this is a global issue right now. What do you see there in terms of the nationalism approach to how we stop the spread of this?
Yeah, so Russia has announced they have a vaccine. They, as I understand it, Vladimir Putin has said it works, in quotes, effectively enough. We hold our vaccines to higher standards than that. But hopefully it is, for Russians' sake, I do hope it is safe. We will see what its results are. There's been a big rush to develop a credible vaccine as fast as possible to demonstrate that the government is doing as much as it can and to show off the science and innovation that a country has. So in that sense, this does have elements of a space race. It shouldn't. Most of the vaccine development worldwide really is going on through a collaboration. Countries have been working quite actively together. It's the one part of this pandemic that has worked well. Within China, publishing the genetic sequence of this vaccine, development of a vaccine started 4 days later, and they were in clinical trials 66 days after the publishing of that genetic sequence. Both of those are records. And it's been really done by a collaboration of scientists around the world. The question is whether or not politicians will act in kind and also act in concert. And right now, that doesn't seem to be the case.
I was going to say, do scientists hold any sway over how political leaders act in the situation of desperation?
So in this case, it doesn't seem that scientists or even companies will necessarily hold a lot of sway in how this vaccine is distributed. And here's why. What we saw in the early stages of this pandemic is that companies made contracts with other governments to provide supplies, again, personal protective equipment, ventilators, and the like. Governments seized them because at the end of the day, governments have the ability to expropriate property that's within their borders and issue export bans. So at the end of the day, this is really going to come down to governments, not scientists, not companies, in deciding how this will be distributed.
When you look at what's happening in the private industry, are you seeing private companies profiting from this pandemic?
So one of the challenges you have with vaccine nationalism is that countries are competing against each other. and every week has brought announcements of new deals with the United States, with the United Kingdom, buying advance large amounts of or reserving large amounts of doses of potential vaccines. So the United States government reached an agreement with Pfizer and a German company, spent $2 billion to reserve 300 million doses, potential doses of that vaccine, should it become effective. That vaccine isn't even in human trials yet. So what you have seen is, with governments competing each other against each other to reserve this capacity, the prices are going higher and higher and higher. This is, again, another reason why it would be better if governments cooperated, because it is only making supplies more scarce and prices higher for them to compete against one another.
I wonder, though, I know India is a powerhouse in making pharmaceuticals. We do, as you mentioned there, see a surge in cases. Are countries that are, quote unquote, good at making pharmaceuticals or have the resources within the industry, do they have a leg up here? Do they have any leverage?
They do. Because, again, the vaccine supplies will be physically within their borders, which puts them under the control of the government. The Serum Institute of India is the world's largest contract vaccine manufacturing powerhouse. They are slated to manufacture several of the vaccines that are leading candidates. Initially, the CEO of that company indicated that any vaccines manufactured domestically would first have to go to Indians. Subsequently, he has modified that to suggest that it would be 50-50 in terms of what would go domestically and what would be allowed to be shared internationally, but has conceded that the Prime Minister Modi might feel otherwise and seize those supplies. They will have a leg up, those countries, in the sense that they'll have vaccines within borders. But again, this really does boil down to national leaders and governments.
We're talking with Thomas Boyke, author of the book Plagues and the Paradox of Progress. We're looking at the ethical issues around a forthcoming COVID-19 vaccine, how countries will vie for doses, and how they will work together or not. You can join in should people be compelled to get a vaccine for the good of public health. What concerns you about the race for as countries work toward a vaccine? Do you find that it will be, are you worried about its efficacy? Join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas, if, say, the government would intervene, limit, if you will, the profits that a pharmaceutical company could make, would that curtail innovation in any way? Would it de-incentivize the speed at which the industry is going after a vaccine or a treatment here?
It might, but it's not likely to occur with vaccines. Quite the opposite. Governments are really shoveling money at the pharmaceutical industry at this point. So the U.S. has spent billions in multiple deals to reserve potential vaccines, should they be successful and proven safe and effective and manufactured in a quality manner. That's not a dumb investment. At the end of the day, the U.S. is losing trillions to this pandemic. Investing in billions in vaccines that may not come to fruition is not going to be a waste of money. It is worth trying to do that, because if you can get them months earlier and reduce the overall economic costs and, of course, the human costs of this pandemic, it will be worth it. But there aren't many governments that are trying to reduce profit. The one thing that has come up, same company in India, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and an international organization called Gavi have reached a deal that for one of the vaccines, there's a commitment of the Serum Institute to manufacture it and sell it at $3 a dose. That's considerably cheaper than what is being charged for instance, remdesivir, one of the first effective treatments for COVID. So that is a good price. Again, it is subject to all the same limitations we described. Can they get it out of India? Should be manufactured there.
Will we have any shortages of the materials that go into such a vaccine, thinking that the vials that the vaccine is even put in or labeling or the ingredients themselves?
Great question. So people focus on the antigen, the active ingredient of vaccines. That is just one piece of what we need here. There is, of course, there's the glass vials. They have there's pharmaceutical grade glass vials. There's rubber stoppers. There's syringes. There's antigen, which is a material used to boost the immune response with a vaccine. All these are going to be needed for vaccines, and comes from all over the world. This is another reason why vaccine nationalism may be a short-sighted approach. Because at the end of the day, as much as the U.S. is trying to move as much of that as possible domestically, they are not going to get there in time. We are not going to get there on glass vials. And depending on the vaccine, we are not going to get there on the antigens that are necessary. We will have to rely on international supplies. If the U.S. is unwilling to share its vaccines, other countries may be unwilling to share their critical supplies. And I'll give you one example. Chile has a raw material, the Chilean soap bark tree, that is used and processed into an antigen in Sweden. Neither Chile or Sweden manufacture vaccines. But that antigen is critical to several of the vaccines that are currently considered promising. So it gives you one sense of how mutually dependent we are and one reason why a my country eats first approach may be so damaging.
Talking with Thomas Boyke about how the world can fight the pandemic in a responsible way, he leads the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the effects of vaccine nationalism on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The head of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said last week on United Nations Web TV that COVID-19 vaccines should be treated as a global public good.
It's not sharing for the sake of sharing. It's only because it has advantages. For the world to recover faster, it has to recover together.
Can the world cooperate in this time? What concerns you most about vaccine deployment and vaccine development? First, it's 800-642-1234. We're talking this hour with Thomas Boyke, director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, Thomas, we heard from Maureen in Appleton, called in, couldn't stay with us. Maureen wants to know, how much do you expect the vaccine could cost for an individual?
It's difficult to say. Some of the reports coming out of companies or pharmaceutical companies suggest that the vaccine may cost as high as $40 per dose. The question, of course, is how it would be paid for and how it would be distributed. The Trump administration hasn't provided a great amount of detail. What they initially suggested was that the military, U.S. military, would distribute the vaccine. Subsequently, they've suggested that the U.S. military would handle all the logistics, getting the supplies, getting the vaccine where it needs to go, but distribution would happen through traditional public health channels. We'll see. They haven't put out any official plans as of yet. Would be important because how it's distributed ultimately may influence on what the price will ultimately be.
I would imagine
the end user price, will it be through private pharmacies? Will it be through public health programs? Will it somehow be distributed for free through the military? We have yet to see.
I would imagine it gets more complex, too, if multiple doses are involved.
So we will almost certainly require multiple doses. So when you hear these reports of 300 million vaccine doses being reserved, divide that number at least in half. It is likely that, particularly with the early vaccines, it will require multiple doses, which add to the complexity of how it's going to be distributed, because, of course, you need to track who's gotten it and to ensure that they come back on schedule to get the second dose of the vaccine. The other element that listeners should keep an eye on is how effective these early vaccines are. So one question will be, will you need booster shots every year, or whether or not the protection that's afforded against these vaccines will last longer? Will the vaccines just protect against disease, like your flu shot you get every year, where you can still get flu, but you're much less likely to have a severe case of flu? Or will they truly protect against infection, like your polio vaccine, where you are able to achieve herd immunity and eventually drive the virus out of a geographic area?
Where has the World Health Organization been in refereeing or laying the groundwork for how countries will deploy a vaccine?
Great question. So the World Health Organization has been working hard to move forward the development of vaccines, therapeutics, and diagnostics. They're running the world's largest clinical trial, a solidarity trial, comparing the effectiveness of treatments. Currently, they, together with a number of international organizations like Gavi, which distributes vaccines, and CEPI, the Coalition of Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, which develops vaccines, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, have set up something called COVAX, which is just short for coronavirus vaccines. And that is meant to be a collective approach to developing, procuring, and distributing vaccines. The question is whether or not other countries will sign up for it and get their supplies through there. And right now, the U.S. has not. China has not. India has not. And it remains a question of whether the rest of the world will.
Let's take another call. Now, Mary is joining us from Pewaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Good morning. Yes, I was getting off the conversation with the coordinator that put me on, I heard you say something about the herd immunity effect, and that's kind of what I was going to bring up. Is there any possibility that the people that kind of are refusing to wear masks, I would say people that are kind of following our leader, and I put that in air quotes, that they may also be the same people that will refuse to take the vaccination once the vaccine is then, distributed worldwide? And if so, then, of course, that herd immune factor is, if under, like, 80%, I think,
Mary,
a problem.
Yeah, Mary, thank you. When a vaccine is developed, Thomas, should governments force people to take it?
So let's start with what we have now in terms of people's confidence with the vaccine. And right now, unfortunately, in the United States, it's low. So only most recent polls suggest only 1/3 of Americans trust the administration's response to COVID-19. Recent polls suggest that only 75% of Americans would get the vaccine when it became available. Those numbers vary significantly by race. So the numbers are worse among Black Americans and Latino populations. It is probably not the wisest idea to have named the vaccine development program Warp Speed. It doesn't give people the sense that it's being carefully developed. It sounds like it's being rushed. So that may be impacting people's confidence as well. So one part that will be very important in the months before we have a vaccine is to provide greater assurance to the public that it's being developed safely and that it's effective and it will be distributed in a way that will keep the people who take it safe, because we need to get those numbers up. It is important whether or not a vaccine can achieve herd immunity that that's the case. As I mentioned before, and as you were linking in with your great question, Mary, is that it's not clear whether or not these early vaccines can achieve herd immunity because they may or may. It's not clear that they'll protect against this infection. The early vaccines may work more like your flu shot, where they just protect people from getting more severely ill. That is still worth taking because, again, if we can, a vaccine, and the FDA has set a standard that has to be at least 50% effective to be approved, a vaccine that is 50% effective at reducing severe consequences of COVID is well worth taking. So the question is whether we can convince more people to do so. I am not sure in the current circumstances, with people being as wary as they are, that this is a good environment to mandate compulsory immunization of the U.S. population. I do think what you're likely to see is that our ability to access life, such as public schools, perhaps many private schools, many workplaces, will require some certification of vaccination. I think that's appropriate, and that will be the form of compulsion that is likely to happen. But I don't think we will see the government likely to be forcibly immunizing people.
We're talking with Thomas Boyke, who is founder and managing editor of Think Global Health. It's an online magazine examining ways health shapes economies, societies, our everyday life around the world. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Saul now, joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi. I just had a question about logistics, and as I understand it, the mRNA vaccines like the Moderna vaccine, which is the most advanced in testing so far, these mRNA vaccines are very unstable and require storage at minus 80 degrees centigrade, and these are very expensive freezers. I'm wondering, practically speaking, how can we disseminate a vaccine which, if my information is correct, requires such exotic cooling?
So, great question, Saul. Thank you for it. On the Moderna vaccine, there are a number of RNA vaccines that are under development. Moderna is one of them. It is the most advanced U.S. candidate. The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is probably a bit ahead in vaccine development, but those two are quite close. We never had an approved RNA vaccine before, new technology. So that's one bit of uncertainty here. The technology is quite promising. It really has won over many scientists and policymakers, but we will be starting a bit afresh with the RNA vaccines. Those are not likely to become a global bull against this pandemic for two reasons. One is the cold chain requirements you've described, that it be maintained, be sufficiently refrigerated. Second is that very few countries can make it. So vaccine manufacturing capacity in general is quite limited. RNA vaccine manufacturing capacity is extremely limited. What you're more likely to see is either the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, which is an older technology, or the Janssen vaccine that is underdeveloped, become the worldwide tools for fighting this pandemic. I think listeners should expect that there will be more than one vaccine that succeeds in this process. That's how robust the scientific response has been. Right now, there are well over 160 in development, 26 in clinical trials, 6 in phase 3 clinical trials. I would expect as the months go by that we will see more than one vaccine. And particularly with regard to mRNA vaccines, we'll need more than one vaccine because it won't be the global solution.
Talking with the Council on Foreign Relations global health expert, Thomas Boyke is our guide to the best way for the world to cooperatively fight the pandemic and vaccine development. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Thomas Boyke from the Council on Foreign Relations. We're discussing what happens when a COVID-19 vaccine emerges or multiple ones emerge, how it gets distributed on a global scale, and what the implications are going to the highest bidder or the most doses to the richest countries. We're getting the historical context of nationalistic behavior. Let's take another call now. Chuck is joining us, and Chuck is a truck driver going through Wisconsin. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing all right. What is on your mind about a COVID vaccine?
My question is, there's two different strands of this virus, and which strand are they getting the vaccine for? And if by the time they get the vaccine, is it already going to have mutated?
So great question, Chuck, and thanks for calling in and your interest. Right now, the vaccine has been pretty stable. That's actually a blessing. One challenge we've had is developing vaccines against coronavirus in the past, because some of the other coronaviruses that have been out there, so you may remember SARS in 2002, 2003, that struck China, Toronto, and about 29 other countries. There is a Middle Eastern variety that you've heard of. As you know, many of the viruses that cause the common cold, four of them are coronaviruses, and we struggled making vaccines against those. This particular virus seems to be stable. So that's one reason why people are hopeful that we will have a vaccine and that we're likely to have multiple vaccines, because it seems to be a pretty good candidate to develop a vaccine against.
Well, that sounds like good news there.
It is good news, and it could have even worse. I mean, we've put billions into trying to develop a vaccine against HIV and have not been successful, despite, you know, heroic scientific efforts, because it is a devilishly difficult virus to develop a vaccine against. So one fortunate element of this particular virus, for all the damage that it has done, is that it seems to be very amenable to the scientific tools that we can develop. The question, again, will be who gets access to those tools once they come onto market.
Chuck, thank you. Let's bring in Gail now in Chautauqua. Hi, Gail.
Hi, from Chautauqua, Gail. Okay, so I received the flu vaccine or flu shot for years, and then about 4 years ago, I got a flu shot, and I had a reaction to it where my throat, I felt like I swallowed a walnut, and so they wouldn't give me flu shots anymore. And I'm curious if you have any insight into the coronavirus vaccine, if that's going to be along the same lines as somebody like me that doesn't react well to the flu shot would be a candidate for the coronavirus vaccine.
Will we see similar allergic reactions for the vaccines that are coming to market?
So great question. And certainly in your case, my best advice, of course, will be to consult your physician when it comes out. What I will say is a number of the vaccines under development are likely, what we're seeing from clinical trials, may cause soreness in individuals. That's not a life-threatening, of course, consequence. You may have gotten it experienced it from some of your childhood vaccinations, where you get that feeling of a dead arm and soreness. But one challenge you have is an environment where the population is already wary of this vaccine for all the reasons we've talked about before. Having a reaction to the vaccine is going to be something that is going to be important for policymakers and physicians and medical associations to really educate the public about, because you don't want people overreacting to that sensation and feeling that somehow it undermines the safety of a vaccine at all. It's a classic symptom of some vaccines, but it's another reason why it'll be really important to have better public health communication than we've gotten from our politicians so far.
Public health, I want to stay there for a moment, Thomas Boyke. You've said that humans' effectiveness at fighting infectious disease has had an unintended consequence and a neglect of public health systems. What are you seeing there?
So this is the particulars of this coronavirus, where it developed, how the timing, none of that could have been predicted. On the other hand, it was well predicted that a respiratory virus, a novel respiratory virus, could do an enormous amount of damage and was inevitable. People have predicted it against decades, for decades. The challenge we have had, and this is the part that's described in my book, is that most of the progress we've achieved historically against infectious diseases actually occurred before the widespread public availability of antibiotics and vaccines. We did it through public health. We did it through investment in clean water and sanitation, housing reforms, labor reforms. 60% of the life expectancy that Americans have gained since 1870 occurred before we had effective treatments for most infectious diseases. That said, in the last several decades, most of our progress has become dependent on medicines and vaccines. And what you have seen worldwide, including in this country, is declining support for public health, for investments in sanitation and infrastructure, for robust enforcement of housing and labor laws. And what that has left us vulnerable to is a novel virus, like this coronavirus, for which people are, for which effective treatment are seen and people are highly susceptible. And I'm sad to say it's exactly what we're seeing. So the book really describes how we've addressed these problems in the past and how societies overcame them, and perhaps provide some guide to what we should be looking at for our future with this virus.
In particular, communities of color in our country have been particularly hard hit by this pandemic. Why is the U.S. health system failing communities of color?
So it's a combination of factors. Part of it, of course, is that many community of color members are more likely to be essential health workers. So they're working. Their housing conditions are more crowded. We, in general, have had inequitable access to health care and poor health care that's being delivered. You can see that through maternal mortality rates for Black Americans. So again, this is not a surprise that we are seeing this in these communities. We're just paying a very visible price for it that's getting the world's attention now. And that has to be, you know, one will hope we will learn something from this crisis. And one of those lessons will have to be providing better protections in future pandemics, because there will be future pandemics for communities of color and other vulnerable populations that may not have their needs addressed otherwise.
In our last moments together, will this pandemic shape how our world responds to future major global problems?
So, Lord, I hope so. I can probably speak for most of your listeners on that front. One would hope we learned something from this crisis and we profit from it in terms of making investments to ensure that we do not have the type of disastrous response that we see, not just in the United States, but really, frankly, globally against this pandemic. Some of that will depend on our ability to cooperate. And to tie it back to vaccines, if we cannot cooperate on an effective medical invention that it is in all of our interests to share in order to stop a pandemic that puts us all at risk, what global problem are we going to cooperate on? What is our hope for addressing climate change, nuclear proliferation, or any other challenges that require countries to work together if we cannot work together in the midst of a pandemic on sharing a vaccine?
Thomas, thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thomas Boyke is director of the Global Health Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Just ahead, it is On Point. Working from home has become the norm for some these last months, but will it endure after the pandemic? We explore the future of the virtual workplace. That's On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.